When I was a kid, playgrounds were all about jungle gyms, monkey bars, swings, and seesaws. But in recent years, designers and psychologists have been developing new ideas of just what child's play should look like. The Imagination Playground, which opens later this month at South Street Seaport, will be the first permanent demonstration of what could be the future of play. To talk about modern playgrounds and their role in child development, we are joined now by David Rockwell, CEO and founder of the Rockwell Group and the architect behind the Imagination Playground, along with Roger Hart, a psychologist and director of the Children's Environments Research Group at the CUNY Graduate Center. And I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hi.
Nice to be here.
Hello there.
Roger, you're talking to us from Turkey?
That's right.
You're not doing a playground in Turkey, are you?
I'm playing with kids a lot here, but yes, it's a vacation on the south coast of Turkey with my Turkish family.
David, we're all familiar with the traditional playgrounds in city parks. What makes an imagination playground?
Well, we got involved in playgrounds really as a result of a few things, but part of it was me playing with my two young kids and playing in a lot of playgrounds. And fascinated to see, and of course, New York City has great playgrounds, but I felt like there was a sameness in the play value. And as I started to do research, I had, you know, real-life test research with my kids, and I found that for them to play longer and harder and more imaginatively, part of the key was variety. So it began a five-year journey of looking into the most basic component of play that would stand alongside the traditional playgrounds you mentioned, which are gross motor skills, but that would be focused on creativity.
So you're not trying to replace the old-fashioned playground?
No, not at all. I think that, you know, from the beginning, what inspired me was, first of all, private-public partnership, which I think is kind of an amazingly powerful tool as a designer to not wait for the phone to ring, but proactively to say, this is an area where a great deal more creativity could be put. And the second thing is realizing that what kids do better than any grown-up can do for them is imagine their own play environment and create it spontaneously together.
Roger, I hear you're trying to get into this conversation. Go ahead.
No, good. I agree with all of that.
Go ahead.
No.
Well, can these playgrounds be boxed up and set up anywhere? Is that part of the concept here?
Well, what happened was, and Roger from Turkey is, you know, really one of the heroes here. We reached out to a large group of people who were vested in children's play. And, of course, I've got to tell you, the moment I said I was doing a playground, I quickly found out that every parent knows exactly how their kids should play, and they all felt comfortable telling me.
Were they surprised? I mean, you're well known for designing restaurants, for your work at JetBlue's Terminal 5 at Kennedy Airport. You also designed Broadway sets, Hairspray. I mean, playground design doesn't sound like it fits into all of that, or does it?
Well, what fits in about it is what's always interested me was how design brings people together to collaborate. So it is true for 25 years, what I've been focused on are playgrounds more for grown-ups. But as I looked at kids' play spaces, it felt like there was a real opportunity to return to. And, you know, it's interesting that mid-1960s, there was this incredible explosion of creativity around playgrounds, and actually post-World War II in Europe, these adventure playgrounds, which were all about spontaneity. And I read a book, and I think that's, Roger, when you and I first started to talk, I read Susan Solomon's book, Creating American Playgrounds. And there was one fascinating example. It was a playground that Louis Kahn and Noguchi had proposed for Riverside and never got done. And it was a seminal piece of work that was about flexibility. And, you know, when you think about what kids have in the country, they have the ability unfettered to play with less supervision. In the city, it's much harder to get that unstructured play.
Now, Roger, what David suggests here is that there were attempts to do this sort of thing in this country in the past. They've been big successes in Europe since the 50s, haven't they? Why haven't they caught on in the United States?
Well, although there's been a lot of innovative design, and you're right, David, in the 60s there was a great flurry of activity, it was still relying on equipment. It was relying on fixed equipment. And most of the innovation that really worked for children in Europe involved children being more involved in the design process. You know, the thing that suits David's past design is that he's obviously set the stage for all kinds of events, and now he's setting the stage for children to engage. And the idea is here for an architect not to do all the design, but to set the opportunities for children to become the designers. The adventure playgrounds that were built after the war in Northern Europe, initially Scandinavia and then rapidly in Britain, were, you know, the result of not having opportunities because of the war, but the effect was superb because it said, you know, kids can actually create their own play settings.
So they had to make do with what was around?
Yeah, make
and improvise?
Beyond, yes, make do was what it seemed, but in fact it went way beyond what adults had done, because the history of playground design, take in New York, for example, was not trying to think what is best for children's development in the rich way we think now, but was rather related to things like getting kids off the street and controlling their bodies through getting them to really be good at physical play. I mean, literally the idea was if you control their bodies, you could control their minds and their behaviors and make them more compliant, because there was a fear of the incredible numbers of children on the streets, and we just got to get them contained and controlled. And so, you know, we still live largely with an inheritance of this idea of playgrounds being about gross motor, as David said, physical play with the large muscles. And so this is an exciting moment under the new Parks Department to see all the innovation that's happening in New York City now. If you look at the adventure playgrounds in Europe, they're really of two kinds. One was very challenging equipment built not by architects but by play workers, which would be absolutely scary to parents in New York, but was in fact copied to a degree in Central Park on the West Side. People might remember an adventure playground Paul Friedberg was involved in that copied some of those elements. And then another kind of playground that's very common with adventure playgrounds is children building their own houses and even entire settlements of houses, construction with hammers and nails, all of that kind of thing. Those places look like shanty towns. Both versions didn't survive in America because there's no really finite analysis of that, but it appears it was because they were, first of all, very ugly and out of control for a lot of parents. So they looked like anarchy. And also because they required play workers, they required staff. And unfortunately, the United States was already winding down the degree to which it had staff on parks, and since the 60s there's been just a tremendous erosion of that. Until today, we're now starting to see some rethinking of that because of this initiative in the Imagination Playground.
My guests are Roger Hart, Director of Children's Environments Research Group at the CUNY Graduate Center, and David Rockwell, the architect, founder, and CEO of the Rockwell Group. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I'm a bit confused. We've been hearing the phrases adventure playground and imagination playground. Are they the same thing?
Well, imagination playground is what we named this this experience. And you know, the most interesting part of the journey is architects, we are trained to create permanent infrastructure, right?
And if it falls down, the architect gets blamed.
That is true. Not so true with blocks, though. About 5 years ago, when I started to look at this, I went to Adrian Benepe, actually through a suggestion of Amanda Burden. Adrian is Commissioner of Parks and Recreation. I think an incredible resource and passionate about public space. And I said, why do all playgrounds look alike? And we started to develop this idea, which I showed him. And I think really at the core of making something like this happen is, first of all, having a passion that will, you know, there's so many obstacles. In fact, my original proposal was to do a playground in each borough. And we had set up this foundation that funded and built the viewing platform at Ground Zero post 9/11. And after that, several of the people who had funded that said to me, do you want to do another project downtown? We pursued a number of things, a arts center called the Incubator, which I worked on for 2 years, and it was just impossible to get any decision about culture for Lower Manhattan done at that point. And I was passing
There were so many different people who had a say, and they often were disagreeing. We're still seeing it, aren't we, on Ground Zero?
There's still no solution to it. And so, in fact, the city got me a lobbyist who said, David, it's going to take you 20 years, if ever, to make any progress on this. And I was passing Pier 25, which had been a playground where my kids played in Lower Manhattan and had been closed since 9/11 and still has not reopened. And I said, I should have just found a way to give the city a playground. And it began 5 years of research. And the most interesting thing is every test play date we did with public schools, with parks, where we made a number of systems of loose parts and pieces that kids could use, what was phenomenal is these kids would make things and do things no one expected. And they would always start with kids making individual structures. I'll take these things and I'll make a car or a wagon. But every play date, half an hour into it, you would see kids saying, how do I connect my thing to his thing? And you started to see this community play, and it was a major moment of realization for me that these playgrounds where I was taking my kids are where they're learning to collaborate. They're learning communal skills. They're learning to imagine and fantasize. And what they do constantly is surprising and surpasses what we would predict.
So what are you building in Burling Slip in the South Street Seaport? I hear that was once a loading area for Fulton Street Fish Market, the late lamented Fulton Street Fish Market. But are you building something permanent or impermanent?
No, it's a permanent structure. It's about a 20,000 square foot playground, and it has a continuous ramp, and the ramp provides a place for kids to run and play, and it has some basic components. One is a large area of sand with a series of structures that allow a kid to move the blocks around. So all of the loose pieces, the loose parts, and there's about 300 different blocks and about 200 other pieces, wheelbarrows, canvas bags, encourage kids to make their own worlds using sand and water. And so the structure, which is a teak structure, including this small crow's nest that is the place where those loose parts stay, becomes kind of like Kid City, where they'll build their own worlds.
Roger, we've seen some of the dangers of playgrounds, even when we're encouraging kids to do something a little different. For example, the children who burned themselves on the metal orb in Union Square Park, they weren't falling off of monkey bars there. They were actually were playing in an innovative situation. And then those rubber mats that are designed to protect kids when they fall, they can get pretty hot when temperatures reach the 90s, mm-hmm. as we've seen recently here in New York. Luckily, you've been in Turkey and escaping that. But this is a way of getting around all of that, getting past all of that?
I hope not. I mean, you're raising a completely different issue here. I agree with David that he doesn't see this, and I don't see this playground as a replacement for physical play. Mm-hmm. That would be futile. Children wouldn't allow that, neither would parents. It's really an important complement to what we've already got. We've had playgrounds that have been static, where children have not been able to manipulate anything, and it's dramatically restricted the repertoire of opportunities for play that children have had. So with this playground, it's going to supplement that. I believe that as people are influenced by this design, they will do playgrounds increasingly that are an integration of the old playground, that also have loose parts, that have play workers to support that. And I would also hope vegetation and natural elements. That wasn't possible for Rockwell to do on this site because it's obviously a landmark-type site. It's next to a port, as I understand, and so that wouldn't even work. It's also a very small site, so it doesn't lend itself to lots of vegetation. But that whole range of things need to happen on playgrounds. And risk-taking is part of what happens in children's play. And there's been an awful overemphasis on the accidents that happen in U.S. playgrounds. If you look at the data on the accidents that happen in children's homes, they're enormous in quantity compared to the numbers of accidents that happen in playgrounds. It's just that playgrounds lend themselves to suing, mm-hmm. and to the lawyers have a big field day here.
And
so
Roger,
that's why we hear some.
And Roger, yeah. I think it's fair to say that a lot of the discussion of safety has led to the homogenization of play structures,
yeah.
which are no safer than any other. But it's just
but they're more boring.
They're more boring.
Absolutely.
I mean, part of the thrill with monkey bars was that there was a certain amount of risk. And we were aware of them when I was a kid. I was aware of the fact that I could fall and hurt myself.
You know, I'll tell you an interesting story. The first test play date we did, I believe Commissioner Benepe was there and Nancy Berthold from Parks and Recreation and a number of advisors. And Penny Wilson had come over from the UK, who is the leading acting sort of play associate in ran 15 adventure playgrounds in and around London. And as soon as the play date started, you could see 30 adults standing around watching the kids, dying to get in there and tell them what to do. And after about 20 or 30 minutes, it was clear that they didn't really need that. And you asked about the portability. Portability was a surprising cold call from Kaboom, who were out there as the leading advocates for building playgrounds within walking distance of every kid. That's their mission. And they saw the permanent imagination playground and said, can we partner with you and make this available? And that's how that came up from those early test play dates.
Well, this sort of thing could be actually instituted with street fairs. It could be put into an empty lot. It doesn't have to be kept as a permanent park.
And in fact, that's what's being done. We just did the city is touring 10 of the pop-up playgrounds. And by the end of the year, and all of the money from the sales of those playgrounds goes to endowment and creating new playgrounds. And there'll be 100 portable playgrounds by the end of the year.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with more with David Rockwell, founder and CEO of Rockwell Group, and Roger Hart, director of the Children's Environments Research Group at CUNY Graduate Center. Stay with us. We're back with Roger Hart and David Rockwell. We're talking about their new Imagination Playground, which is soon to open at the Burling Slip at the South Street Seaport. When is it opening?
July 27th.
And it seems to me it's part of a whole new sensibility here, the High Line being another example of this sort of thing, something a little innovative, not your usual park.
I think the High Line is nothing short of miraculous on a couple of levels. One is it's making something that was invisible before visible. You know, so those great photographs of the High Line and the overgrown landscape, I think it's given New Yorkers a new perspective on the city. And it also, I mentioned this before, but I think portability is a fascinating thing. Because it suggests that some of the things that create our deepest memories aren't permanent infrastructure. So when you're up on the High Line and you have a different view and you see these amazing landscapes, and it's one of the things that strikes me about kids is so much of what they find memorable is experiences that they're generating themselves versus things that are prescribed or dictated for them.
Roger, you lead the Child Environmental Research Group of CUNY. Yeah. What sort of research are you doing?
Currently, I'm doing research which extends the idea of play opportunity beyond playgrounds, which may be the inappropriate thing to talk about in this show, but I'll just mention it, that many countries, especially in Europe, are rethinking children's access to places beyond prescribed limited settings called playgrounds. That may seem impossible, but in fact, the Dutch have done an amazing job of closing off streets and thereby liberating parents and children to feel confident, the children playing outside. And now Britain's doing the same thing with something called home zones, which are play areas that are created safe. Germans are doing child-friendly cities and child-friendly communities, which have liberated children to play more in the streets because they're safe from traffic. There's a lot of work here that's exciting for New York, and perhaps in the next step to think about how to reinsert children into the city. But at the moment, the playgrounds are the game. It's children have had to retreat to just those spaces.
Well, when I was a kid, we used to play punch ball and stick ball in the streets, but of course the cars would come and the game would be suspended until the cars went by. And we're seeing a lot less of that today. Is it because our police are clearing the streets, or because kids are now have now gotten the message that they can't play on the street?
Well, as a parent, it's hard.
It depends on the age group. The pre-teenagers all over the Western world, and actually in Australia and Japan too, there's been a massive erosion of children's freedom to go outdoors, and it's related to a paranoia about children's social safety. There aren't real indications that parents need to be that concerned, but the mass media seem to have made them so. So it's no longer just traffic. And in the 80s and 90s in New York, of course, the fear of violence and drugs drove a lot of kids indoors. I get the sense that there's more kids on the street now than there was in the 90s. And there's not research on that, but it really looks that way.
You know,
so there is some street play coming back.
There's
but
also
it's older kids. It's not the age group that's going to be mainly coming to the Imagination Playground, which are, you know, primary school children.
But there's, you know, one of the things I think that's interesting is the city's focus on public space, which is really what makes a city livable.
Right.
Pocket parks, little unexpected surprises. And I don't think playgrounds need to talk down to kids. They don't necessarily need to have brightly colored choo-choo trains or be places where grown-ups can't gather. And part of Burling Slip is, I mean, it's amazing to be building this thing at the center of this very historic slip. But there's a lot of seating around the perimeter, which may allow parents to sit and relax and not be so hyper-vigilant.
Mm-hmm. Well, Roger, you've mentioned the importance of independent problem-solving for children. Can parents or teachers ever get in the way?
That's a great question, especially because, you know, when Rockwell first announced this playground, it was on the front page of the New York Times. And there was a mention of play workers. It's an unfortunate term that the Europeans use. And in fact, Rockwell and the Parks Department now uses the term play associates. Play workers sounds like a logical impossibility, actually, play work. And so that's gone. But the idea of play workers that upset so many readers, and there was dozens of articles afterwards about this, is that they assumed we were talking about recreation-type directors, where these play workers would be teaching children to play or directing their play, when in fact it's the very opposite of that. They're really stage managers. They're people who are making sure the equipment is out, the materials are available, that they're clean. And they do some – good play workers do some minimal amounts of demonstration. They might show innovative uses of materials quietly on the side. They're basically giving permission for children to be creative and transformative themselves. They're not doing what is impossible to do, which is trying to support children's play. And I say impossible for some age groups, especially when kids are in the period of imaginative play, you know, dramatically between 3 and 7 or 8 years of age. Adults are not as good at the dramatic social play that happens with objects that we'll be seeing on the Imagination Playground. And if they try, they fail. And so these children are much better than Saturday Night Live or any improv theater you've seen at negotiating relationships with one another, changing the meaning of objects, changing the storyline as they go. This is an amazingly important part of children's development that this playground is going to facilitate happening. So in addition to the problem-solving activities of kids, there's all of the symbolic uses of the materials kids are going to have.
Because kids have an innate drive to play.
And they have.
They do.
And
so
create.
They don't need adults teaching that.
Your graduate student studied a city
absolutely
playground. I'm sorry, I was talking over you. You want to finish what you were saying? Let me ask this question. Your graduate student studied a city playground for children with intellectual disabilities. What did they notice after they filmed them?
Well, they were actually working at the Playground for All Children, which was an innovative playground at the time. New York City built the first playground to integrate children with all kinds of special needs, not just mental development. And so we were funded by Hasbro Foundation to look at that. And one of the things we found is that there was no social interaction happening between disabled and non-disabled children, and very little social interaction happening even within those groups. So we convinced the staff there to add lots of loose parts, and that did work to a degree, although the groups that came with the disabled children still tended to keep them separate, which is a sad part of the story. So they were physically separated. But whatever social interaction happened there largely happened because of the loose parts materials that we added to the playground. We did compare the play equipment, and there wasn't much difference. The only place where social interaction occurred more than on swings and slides was within a rope area, where kids were kind of forced into one another by the rough and tumble activity that enabled them to really start to connect with one another. So, you know, we really looked at the traditional qualities of physical equipment with that research and found that we had to innovate beyond what the designers had done. It was a $4 million playground, but there was nothing on it that was manipulable. And that's been true of all the playgrounds since the beginning of their bureaucratization. If you look at the photographs before the city started designing them, some of the settlement houses had elements that I think, David, you got inspiration from some of them. They had wheelbarrows.
Yeah.
They had, you know, they played in sand in the very earliest playgrounds. Just some playgrounds were just sand. But then we got into this business of making all playgrounds look the same and limiting them to just outdoor gymnasia type equipment.
Part of the process from a design point of view is we sketched hundreds of interactive play pieces, and as we looked at all of them, we said if we broke this down to its most basic common denominator, and a lot of time looking at block theory, that these pieces would allow kids to create whatever their imagination was sort of inspiring them to do. And you mentioned parents. Do parents ever get in the way? We had an interesting. I was at the Aspen Ideas Conference last week talking about play. And we had a portable playground out there, and every time I walked by, there were another group of grown-ups making something with it, which was fascinating. And then there were a group of kids that that sort of took it over, and it was amazing. Just something as simple as the grown-ups were creating recognizable, iconic things, and the kids were creating places that were more about connection and experience and moving from piece to piece. And that variety, and it was 150 blocks in one of these typical portable playgrounds.
Don't we see that sort of thing, the differences with something as simple as a train set, which the parent buys for the kid and sometimes takes over, but the kids play with the train set differently than the adults do.
Yeah, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I think kids...
But the kids will play with anything. I mean, the toy soldiers, they can develop battles. Their imaginations really can be quite powerful.
Right in the middle of this process, when we were just starting to develop the documents for the permanent part of the playground, I had ordered an art table for my two kids. And I came home because I wanted to see, you know, I was going to make it incredibly organized with the colored pencils in one drawer. They were out in the hall playing with the two boxes that it came in the foam pellets, and it was so much more fun than the desk, you know, and it just makes you sort of think about where you're putting your emphasis.
Your work includes the Film Society at Lincoln Center, the new Meadowlands Stadium Suites, the set design for a new show, Free Man of Color, which opens in October at Lincoln Center, and I mentioned some of the other things that you've done, including a lot of restaurants here in New York. You do all of that for a living, right?
I do all of that for
what
a living.
What about this?
Well, this has been a labor of love, and we've found that we've gotten, first of all, a lot of other people who want to participate. People really do want to make a difference, and as a designer, as an architect, it's, I think, important to remember that you don't have to wait for the project assignment now. You need the other paying work to offset that. But it all, I think, makes the work richer. I think it makes our theater work richer to be working with kids, particularly around spontaneity.
But as you said earlier, Roger, or both of you have talked about the fact that this will require adults to participate. And that means money. In fact, everything means money. Where's the money coming from?
Well, the money for we've donated all of our work and the design team's work over the last 5 years and the development of the pieces and the parts. LMDC, Lower Manhattan Development Corp, is paying a large part of the construction piece. The city is paying as well. And the city also paid for a lot of the infrastructure work just to make what was a parking lot a buildable site. And then we're raising with the city an endowment, which we've been very successful at, and I think the next 2 weeks are going to be even more successful, so that the support of the maintenance of it. I mean, just something as simple as a playground made out of wood requires maintenance. And there, you know, so once you make everything so that it requires no maintenance, it eliminates a lot of options. So the endowment is privately funded.
Roger, do you see this as an opportunity to have a laboratory studying the way kids play, or has that already been done with all of the European playgrounds of this sort?
No, I mean, this playground is different than the European playgrounds. One of the things that's profoundly different is that the adventure playgrounds we talked about were really 7 and up. In fact, if you see the film 7 Up, you can see the first one of that amazing film series is you see children in an adventure playground. But that was rare. Usually it was for kids at least, you know, 7 or 8 and older, up to 13, 14 in these adventure playgrounds. So this playground that's opening now, the Imagination Playground, is going to be with a bigger age range. It's going to, I think, be particularly attractive for young children. We know that kids in the preschool years and the lower elementary school are really excited by symbolic play and in construction play. And the problem solving and imaginative activities that can happen with that are going to be very appealing to those. Because older children don't have much opportunity to, they're going to be there also. But in the long run, this kind of playground will benefit most children up to, I think, 9-10 years of age. At that time, organized games become more, you know, important to them in terms of activity. That's not totally answered your question, was it?
No, but it doesn't matter because we've run out of time, would you believe it?
Okay.
But I want to thank the two of you so much for talking with us. It sounds really exciting. And again, when is it open?
Opens July 27th.
At the Burling Slip at the South Street Seaport.
Come by and see us.
My great thanks to Roger Hart, director.
I wish I could be there, David. Okay.
Yeah, but you're in Turkey. Bye-bye. It's okay. Roger Hart, director of Children's Environmental Research Group at the CUNY Graduate Center, and David Rockwell, the architect, founder, and CEO of the Rockwell Group. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, we'll find out how the rise of political Islam has intensified the debate over women's rights and led to a growing Islamic feminist movement. And then we preview a festival of early films that were made here in New York. Also, a new documentary that looks at the unintended consequences of international efforts to alleviate poverty in Africa, plus one man's quest to live off the land in Flatbush, Brooklyn. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and with help today from Stephanie Bernhardt, Johanna Barr, and Matt Joseloff. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here at noon tomorrow.